The Strand Gamers present How We Roll, the show that asks the difficult and largely pointless questions about gamers, their games, and the community that surrounds them.
Okay, we're on.
With another episode of How We Roll?
Yes. You know, this
on
is
the
how
last
they do
episode
it
of
on,
How We Roll.
Like, Jeopardy or Family
Feud. Oh, yeah, they do
or
it
anything.
Back to back.
They just like shotgun hours. Like 5 episodes a day, and everybody changes their clothes and pretends it's a different day.
Yep.
I mean, it kind of makes sense.
It does make sense from a production standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. But so we were actually talking. There are two things that we want to address, apparently. The first is NPCs, and the second is horror comedy games. I guess
what?
This is sort of becoming a mailbag. Oh, yeah, that just happened, like, today. Or the other day.
Yes,
we have a
yes.
comment from... We have a comment from Joseph asking if we have advice for running a horror comedy game, which I think it's kind of funny that we would be considered authorities on this at all, but I guess maybe our games are hilarious. Aren't
it's
they?
It's hilarious.
Aren't
it's
they?
Scary.
Tell you what, I'll knock that one out right out of the park. Joseph, I don't know why you think I know anything about this, but I guess what I would do in that situation is focus on... As the GM, focus on the horror, and the comedy is probably going to come out of their reactions to it, out of your players. Because the horror setup, if you wanted to maintain a horror atmosphere, you should be the straight man.
Yeah.
And what makes the horror genre work is that characters in horror are willing to go, let's split up. Oh god, this can't be happening. You know, Martians can't be real. And then that person dies. I think the comedies will come in from your players' awareness of those tropes and their desire to either subvert them or ignore them completely.
Or alternatively, to follow along with them such to the point that it becomes parody.
Yes, that works too. Yeah, I think as GM, your best bet is playing... You are the horror side, and your players are the comedy side.
I mean, it's going to happen no matter what. Like, we play these games to have fun, you know? So what'll happen is... how many times do we do a session in Nightingale where, you know, we don't mean to, but suddenly we all just start laughing out of nowhere because somebody has said something gut-wrenchingly stupid or hilarious? Or both. Often both. Just happens for me. Maybe I'm just not a very funny guy.
So, wasn't recorded. This was before the days of recording, but I did a Cthulhu one-shot that got a lot of laughs from a bed.
Oh god, that bed.
Mostly, this house was possessed, and the bed is, you know, an instrument of the poltergeist. And the player went into the room, looked at the bed. Yeah, whatever. It was a sparse room with a window and a bare metal bed frame. He checked back in the room, and the bed had moved spots. Now they go insane. They form basically a death blossom. They're all back-to-back, guns out, convinced this bed is coming for them.
Yep.
Strip it down into parts. All right, job done. Go back in. Bed is reassembled itself.
We took a long time taking apart that bed. Like, I think part of the hilarity comes from how long we spent contemplating this bed. What to do with this bed, about this bed, because the moment that bed moved, it became a fucking problem.
Yes.
But it makes sense. Like, in retrospect, you're like, well, of course the players would do that. They'd go nutso because, I mean, it's a Call of Cthulhu game, and you're going to go crazy. Everybody goes
crazy. I mean,
that
bed is obviously a ghost.
Right. Finally, the last time they checked in on this room, they didn't see the bed because it was hiding behind the door. So the character's first instinct was to look out the window to see if it had gone outside. And at this point, Bed sees its opportunity, flies at him, and knocks him out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just playing straight up, like, okay, this is what the poltergeist thing would do. And the players were playing straight up, paranoid inability to let anything go.
Yep.
Like, I don't really know the point of that story, but I guess don't try too hard. Trying too hard on parody or comedy is death.
Yes.
Yeah, often the best comedy is what comes naturally, because, I mean, ultimately, laughter, like, we laugh at novelty. We laugh at a violation of expectations. It's exactly what it's about. It's not about, you know, there is no formalized way of writing. I mean, there are formal rules of writing jokes, but, like, you know, they're not, they're more holistic than they are, like, standardized. What you'll have is, the thing about the poltergeist bed is that for us, the players, because I remember being in that campaign, it came out of nowhere. We had no fucking clue what was going on.
Yeah.
In retrospect, like, it's hilarious, and it certainly was funny for Nick.
Our characters didn't even know what we were supposed to be looking for.
Yeah. Which we just heard about strange happenings in the house.
The bed was like the first bit of anything we saw, which is why we fixated on it so much.
Mm-hmm. And it just became a common thread throughout the entire campaign. And it just, you know, nobody said it had to be the bed, but it came about naturally. And there it was.
Oh, and here's a general piece of really GMing and even playing characters in games that relates to comedy. If you can, get familiar with how improv works. Because that's basically what you're doing at a table. Is long-form improv. And the basic tenets of that is yes and. You agree to what another person is telling you and then further it, and don't block. You know, keep things moving forward instead of creating stopping points. And that, those are rules of comedy improv, but they apply very strongly to tabletop role-playing games.
So this gets into an interesting point for me, because we were actually just talking about how I could run a game. I mentioned that I'm very scared of the idea of improv in a game, because I don't... One of the things that I mentioned right away was that I don't know what I would do in a situation where if I had this plot that came together and suddenly the NPCs did something roughly akin to what Kevin did in one of the more recent episodes of Nightingale and just threw everything that I had right off the rails. Mm-hmm. As a GM, I would have no idea what to do in a situation like that.
Well, I'm going to get into it. Here's my secrets. There is no long-term plot arc. I do not have milestones I want to hit. My villains have plans that are sketchy at best. And it comes down to my whole planning style is in the creation of the NPCs. Because when I make an NPC, the things I fixate on are what do they want and what tools do they use to get it. Because if I know those two things, I can adapt to anything my players do.
Mm.
That's it. Like, I mean, if I know, I'm trying to think of a good character I can pull out who won't reveal things about ongoing games.
Hmm. You could even look at some stuff in retrospect.
Yeah. I mean, Argentum Trumbull.
I think you're going to bring him up. He seemed like a good example for all of this. Like, yeah, how many times did we change or, like, mutate something just because of, like, how crazy magic is in Burning Wheel, and he adapted to all of it?
Yes, and Argentum Trumbull, tying into something we talked about last time, what he really wanted was love and recognition because he sure as shit didn't get it from his father.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And man, he did not know how to get it.
No.
He did not know at all. And he was so bad.
It honestly was his major failing.
Yeah, so yeah. For him, his conflated idea of self-worth became pure power. Because that's what his dad was all about. It was all about magical power.
Yeah, ruling everything and immortality. That'll make my sons love me.
And there's a good guideline for making NPCs. Most people have either daddy issues or mommy issues. And when you take extreme characters like that, it's probably going to be played to the extreme. So, yeah, what I knew about Argentum is, yeah, what he wanted, which is power and recognition, didn't really care the form it took. And I know that he would use any means necessary, but he's also a coward. So, he pretty much never put himself in direct danger. I can't remember how much of this came out in the game, but a lot of times you guys thought that you were interacting with him. You were.
That we were interacting with a ghost or an illusion of him. Yes, yeah. That was actually a really interesting reveal when it did happen. When we realized that he could do that, because it kind of made it allowed us to really refocus like the perspective that we took in a lot of our other interactions with him. It's like, so it turns out he is, yeah, a goddamn coward. Hated confrontation.
So yeah, and I might have ideas of an end goal, but that's just because I know what my characters want. And it's usually not specific, because, I mean, most characters do not specifically want to destroy the city, or summon Bahamut or whatever. That's just a tool they happen to be using to achieve what they actually want. Yeah. So if a player derails it such that that's not possible, I mean, most villains aren't going to stop. They're just going to divert themselves.
Mm-hmm. Try and figure out something new that they can do.
Yeah, different track to the same end goal.
Yeah, I find a general rule is that the more elaborate the scheme you construct,
the easier it is to completely tear apart. Yeah.
The more it's not going to happen.
Yes.
Like, over-planning is terrible, and then when you really want that plan to go, you end up railroading your players, and as it turns out, they don't like that.
Oh yeah, they react very violently toward it.
Right. That's the most common mistake of rookie DMs, is to think of a story they want to tell and then try to make the players live it.
What's the what is the the counterpart to that? How do we make stories out of how do we make a story to tell if it's almost verboten to do that?
So my strategy is, instead of trying to tell a story, I will create a world and fill them with people and basically have the world and people embody the themes of the story I want to tell. You know, there's no specific chapters, there's no specific mile markers I want to hit. It's just, you know, here are the vague ideas of what I want this game to be about. And it's going to be set in a place and filled with people who further that.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
And another thing is how I fool people into thinking there's a long-term plan is I throw out a lot of hooks and breadcrumbs.
And see which ones catch.
Which ones catch, and most of the time, I have no idea what's at the other end of that. Uh-huh. Like, if you follow the trail, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's a world that people, it's a world that people create at that point. Like, you take the hook and it's not...
It becomes a journey we're going on together.
At the same time, though, I sometimes do like the idea of, providing ample hooks for your players, but if they don't catch it, if they don't catch the hook immediately, like, that subplot doesn't die. It merely kind of goes on in the background without them.
Yeah.
Parts of the world will develop without your characters.
That's and true.
Sometimes, that might not be the most pleasant thing.
Yeah, something that kind of reminds me of something that I remember when you were trying to run that campaign with me, John, and Dave. You had that sort of that sort of endgame thing that you were talking about, how like basically if we hadn't done something or gone through like the plot hook that we needed,
eventually the
campaign would have come to an abrupt end.
There were many, like, you guys had more than just like a chance to get into it. You guys had many. And I honestly wanted it to be kind of like a Groundhog's Day sort of deal, where if the abrupt end happened, you'd wake up knowing what you know about things and would have to explore more. Explore different parts of this situation.
In like Majora's Mask style?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Huh.
Until you, figure out how to prevent it. At the same time, I also had like three sorts of ways to, rather I should say three factions were trying to bring campaign to said abrupt end through different methods.
So
I think you've hit on a style that's quite distinct from mine, but is an effective way to tell a story without railroading people. Mm-hmm. Is essentially the idea of modular story pieces. That, like, if these players don't hit it then, that's okay. It'll either happen without them, or I can shuffle it up ahead so they get another pass at it.
Yeah. And certainly if it happens without them, like, it's not like there's no chance they're going to notice it happening without them. Like, they will have other opportunities to look and be like, hey, guys, things are changing in ways. Maybe we should do something.
I wonder if there's anything really wrong with the story going on in the background behind players. I mean, I guess the abrupt end kind of scares me, but...
Well, I mean... In my campaign, sort of thing where you, even though the abrupt end happens, you still have more chances to explore why.
Like, you just keep realizing that it's going to happen, figuring out that you can't change it, but maybe you can see why it's going on.
Well, no, you can change it.
Yeah. But, I mean, you might not be equipped with the knowledge you need yet.
Correct.
So, one of the other DMs on the site, Evan, who ran our vampire games... He is someone who, if you watch him start up a campaign, he's got 100 pages of notes.
Oh, wow.
And he knows exactly when everything's going to happen. Our Dark Ages game, he had a fucking calendar. And it's like 2 weeks after game starts, the NPCs are going to do this, unless the players have stopped them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting, like, flowchart kind of style.
Just a calendar, really, of when each thing is happening and everything that's happening in the background. Some of it barely touched on us, which I mean, is a great way to create an in-depth world, but I've also seen him put in a shit ton of front-loaded work and burn out because of it.
Yeah.
And that's why I just try to create an illusion of a detailed world.
Oh. I think that if you're going to create a world so detailed, you need to give the players ample opportunity to explore it and, you know, experience all the detail that you have put into the world. But you, of course, can't railroad them into it. You have to entice them.
Exactly. I think a great example of how I do things is in our Lost Nightingale game, Russell. So I knew starting the campaign I wanted to bring Russell back at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he was an interesting character that I had, I had some fondness for. Now, I didn't know where Russell would come in. I dropped a hint of him into one of the Jackrabbit broadcasts. Still had no idea what I was going to do with him. When Kevin's character Will was looking for a new job, he got a text message from a mysterious and rather creepy source, you know, telling him to meet up for this nondescript, off-the-books job.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that ended up being Russell. I had no idea at the time. It was just another hook I threw out to, like, things are happening.
When you made that hook, you mean to say that like it wasn't Russell at the time the hook happened, and then you just
decided it could have been any creepy guy, but it ended up being Russell.
It could have been any creepy guy. You pursued it, and I thought, okay, this is a good idea to bring Russell in. What's Russell working on? Well, Prometheans are all about electricity, and that ties in very well with Will's character. Mm-hmm. So it's an electric substation. So that was good enough at the time. You started poking into it further, and it's like, okay, he's making himself some sort of weird Frankensteinian gel bath. What's that gonna do? Didn't know. Didn't know what it was gonna do, didn't know what it was supposed to do.
Neither did I.
Exactly. Like, I only need to be a half step ahead of you guys.
Yeah.
And once that resolved in the substation, I didn't know what happened to Russell after. And I didn't figure it out until I needed an NPC to be at a place to witness a thing to let you guys know. And I had introduced that piece that I hadn't committed elsewhere, so I was able to slot him in there. There's a lot of pieces and threads hanging out that I will only weave together as it becomes necessary.
Yeah, like, we haven't really pursued Rufus Irons at all.
No. Yeah,
I mean, he's come up.
Yeah, I threw him out that he went missing, according to one of the Jackrabbit podcasts, and you guys have learned that he is in the Safe Harbor Society.
Maybe if we went looking for him, we could have found him.
Maybe.
But we didn't.
And that's the thing. No one's going to remember the hooks that they didn't pursue.
Yep.
So, I mean, maybe half of what I throw out ends up being followed up
on. Throw up. You said it.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Half the shit I vomit out at you guys. And that's fine, because that just makes it seem like there's a bigger world going on. And there is. I just don't have to know what it is. And I'll tell you right now, I don't know what's up with Rufus Irons.
Oh, okay. Well then.
We could definitely figure it out.
He's apparently missing.
I know the kind of things that Rufus Irons is about, and I know what people who might want to hurt him might do. So if you end up following it up, I can make a good guess at what might have happened to him and sort of tweak it based on what would be most dramatically interesting at the time.
All right. I'm down with that.
Okay. Okay.
Well, good, because that's what's been happening for the last 10 years.
So. So can I just say that my least favorite part of making a new NPC is naming them?
Why?
I don't know. I feel that like every name I come up with for my NPCs is dumb.
Okay, the naming conundrum, yes.
Yeah, it's like, you want a good name, but then you just go to like a name generator, and it's like, all these names suck. You can't say why they suck, you just hate them.
And you don't want your character to be named Lamp.
Yes.
So, what if I'm going to introduce a new NPC, if I'm making them ahead of time, then I will go to a name meaning site. Usually I'll have an idea of, you know, country of origin or just the idea of a theme that's going to fit them well, and then I will look up a meaningful name. Now, which players are never going to track that down, because who the fuck knows what the name Helfrida means? Yeah. It means elf strength, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Huh.
So, I will say that in my current D&D campaign, my hate of naming characters led me to creating the canon decision that wizards only go by one name. They have like one name. It's like okay,
Cher, Sinbad.
No, not quite like that. It's like, okay, there's a wizard. And my players, knowing that I hate naming them, like, what's his name? I'm like, fuck you guys. That's his name. No.
So.
It's like, Tenanziel. Yeah. Tenanziel what? No, it's just Tenanziel. Wizards only have one name.
But that's actually, that like made the world a little bit more interesting as a result.
It did. So then I had to come up with, ended up
like, imagine
a whole bunch of other wizards.
No, imagine it. Yeah, imagine a wizard school called the Coalition of Steve, and everybody is named Steve.
No, they're not.
But the thing is that they choose their
wizard names, so they end up not being Steve. They're all pretentious bullshit.
Boring.
What?
Imagine like an entire quest line where you had to talk to a bunch of people who all had the same name to you, but it turned out that they all were able to tell each other apart because of very subtle ways in which they pronounced their names that you couldn't understand, but they could, which is why they were a secret society.
What? No.
That's how they communicate.
No, you just came up with the man-bird race from Ugly Americans.
Did I?
I've never seen their language consists of suck my balls. And it's all about inflection. It's a very subtle and nuanced language.
So, back to the original naming problem. One of my DMs, Chris Perkins over at WotC, is better than me. And he solved this problem that he has a giant binder. And it's got sections, elf, dwarf, human. And if he needs to name an NPC on the fly, he just, you know, flips open to the dwarf section, reads off one of the thousands of names he has in there. All right, his name is Steel Hammer Hands. And then he'll make a little note by that name that says, used on this dwarf guard on the island of Anchorage.
Huh. Hmm. That's interesting. So,
I mean, it's a great system if you're willing to take the time and set it up.
I'm not.
Yeah, exactly.
I think most people aren't.
I mean, it's really not that hard. You could go to a fancy name generator and print out 100 names.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I absolutely refuse to name them because, I mean, the NPC is not an NPC of note. They will never see them again. But they're like, what's his name? I'm like, does it matter? Does it matter? Do you want me to spend 5 minutes agonizing over this guy's name? It's usually more than 5 minutes. When you're going to talk to him for like this about as long as it takes me to fucking name him and then never see him again. The demand.
Yes, it matters.
I mean, it can matter to the players, and ultimately that's kind of what it's about, is the players.
I would say that it matters because you never know who is going to become a recurring NPC.
It's true.
I think Nathan Cole is a great example of that.
Yep.
And that was entirely a player decision. Like, Alice wanted to latch on to him.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
It happened.
Well, that's it. It's a player decision.
So.
Yeah. He was there to be, all right, you guys were attacked by the police. The natural outcome of that is there is going to be some lawyer from the government going to try to muzzle you and write you off of the settlement. Like, he was a pure character out of necessity that I gave him a name because he needed to introduce himself. And then Alice came in and made him an actual character.
Yep.
Just by persistence of wanting to talk to him.
I've had that happen with a few of my minor characters, which I do. I do put even minor characters down. And this podcast is brought to you by Microsoft anyways. On my Microsoft Surface Pro first generation, I use Microsoft OneNote. Which I find is actually really well suited to keeping notes for RPGs and whatnot. I have just, you know, a whole notebook of characters. And I keep them all there because I, of course, don't know when they'll come back. Some of them, I read the name and my short description of them, and I'm like, who the fuck is this? Others, though, like, just a name. I haven't put down a description for them at all because I thought that'd be like nothing at all, but they show up all the fucking time.
Am I really the only person who doesn't have a problem with naming characters?
I would say you're rare, yes.
Yeah.
But Kevin, we're going to have a holy war because I use Evernote.
Evernote? So, is that like OneNote?
It's like OneNote, but with elephants.
Yes, I think it's exactly like OneNote. But yeah, it's just a cloud-based note storage thing, software to work on multiple devices. Yes.
Oh, okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a dog in this fight. Like, whenever I name characters, I have a couple of special rules that I follow. Like, does the name sound awkward as fuck to say? Then don't say it. Come up with a different one. There are better names.
I mean, how many characters have you had to make? There have been times I've had to make, like, 5 or 10 for a single session. Who knows how many we'll ever see again. But these people just keep talking to people and expecting them to introduce themselves.
Yeah, that's true. As far as I'm aware, you have not had to run many games. And there comes that moment.
I've run the sword a few times.
Yeah, the sword does not have a ton of characters in it.
No, it has.
You would think that, wouldn't you?
You're in a cave.
Yeah, what happens when you immediately exit the cave?
You don't run into 30 people, and the players don't ask, and what's your name?
Yeah, okay. Admittedly, they don't immediately say, and what's your name? But I did have the, and then what happened after they managed to get out of the cave in like 10 minutes.
Oh. Yes. Well, they win.
Now you understand the experience of DMing.
Yes.
But when they ask, okay, what now? And you have no idea.
It's like, the book doesn't say.
See, that's the bullshit answer.
Yeah.
Get a free fall. Trust your own improv abilities and your players' own dedication to go along with you.
At the same time, though, there have been times where it's like, the things my characters do, the things my players do suddenly introduce a ton of characters out of the blue, and then I suddenly have to start, you know, creating like social circles and whatnot with them and introducing them into the general conflict or whatever that's going on. And it has gotten pretty severe. Some sessions I have to be like, okay, we've only gotten like an hour and a half into this, but I need to stop. GM needs to load.
Yes. That is a luxury.
Things
change with the recorded games.
Ah,
just because pausing is such a pain in the ass, I need to splice shit together.
Yeah.
Normally, I would take a break and, you know, get my shit together and be able to go to the bathroom in the middle of a game. For our recorded Skype games, I cannot do that. At least not easily. Tom, you asked me a while ago, I can't even remember if it was before we started recording, if NPCs were ever inspired by people around me. And the answer is pretty much no. Never by people I actually know. But I do pull from a lot of sources. So for Nightingale, changelings are so fucking weird. I found a great site called fuckyeahchangeling.tumblr.com, which is just a collection of changelingish art. And there are a number of NPCs I just scrolling along like, oh, that crow-looking dude is cool. He's going to end up as the porter on the Goblin Market. So inspired by pictures. Other things are inspired by TV shows, pop culture, whatever I'm into at the moment. One of the minor NPCs from Inquisition of Blood, I wholesale stole the voice from Sherlock. From Moriarty and Sherlock. Now, I do a lot of voices on the podcast, and usually my general rule is it's fine, do a bad impression of someone, because no one will ever recognize it. Because what you're doing, probably not at all like who you're trying to do. This was the one instance that I've ever been called out on it.
Oh, I remember that.
That someone
said. Yeah, it was in the comments.
Yeah, someone commented.
I like that you're channeling Moriarty with Candle.
Huh. Yeah.
Oh. I didn't catch that because I don't watch Sherlock.
You do read the comments on the site, though.
Yes, but certainly when, you know, he did the voice of Candle, I didn't. Yeah. I did like Candle as a character, though. We needed more of him.
And, I mean, the character of Moriarty and Sherlock didn't have much in common with Candle, other than they're both kind of ruthless and crazy.
Yeah, but, I mean, Candle's not a mastermind, whereas Moriarty is, like, the archetypal.
Yes, exactly.
Mastermind.
Like, it channeled in very different ways. So, yes, I will steal from pop culture, even if it's just a voice or a look or a mannerism.
Oh man, this is going to be a really hard thing for me to do. Also, possibly incredibly rewarding, GMing.
Oh, GMing. It can be hard at times.
Yes. I think the hardest thing for me is I don't get a lot of breaks.
Yeah, you do more games than I do.
For sure.
And, like, nonstop.
For the last
forever.
Several years, I've been doing two games. For a stretch of about 2 years, I was doing three games a week. And I think I was running two of them for most of that, and I was playing in a third.
Yeah, it can just be, like, creatively draining.
Yes. I mean, TV shows get seasons. Like, they have a time when they're not writing or filming. For some reason, with tabletop RPGs, that's not the expectation. The expectation is to do every week without stop.
Oh, we could do seasons.
We could, but I also love doing it. Like,
yeah. Well, certainly Burning Wheel somehow gets organized into seasons with the, you know, MVP votes.
Yeah, the arcs and things like that.
Although that goes straight to shit once you actually get into something. And the tangled webs just get more and more tangled as you go down. It's like, it's bullshit all the way down. This arc is never ending. I think the current arc that I've got my Burning Wheel group in has been going on for like 12, 13 sessions, whereas the rules state that, like, you know, every 4 or 5 you should do those trait votes or whatnot.
Yeah, we've never been good at doing that. Because things don't break down into digestible chunks like that.
No, they don't.
Well, not always, anyway. I mean, they can.
They can, but in most cases, they start out looking like something that could be a digestible chunk, and you're like, okay, I can see how this might end up resolving. And then it doesn't resolve in that way at all. It just chains into multiple other things that get all twisted and crazy.
So, yes, DMing can be hard. But also, if I go a couple weeks without a game, I will go crazy.
Why is that, anyway? Like, is it, I mean, I don't know, it just...
Because it seems like
it just seems like some crazy cognitive dissonance that you can simultaneously love and hate something at the same time. Like,
I don't hate it. I mean,
you don't hate it.
It's hard work.
You make.
Okay. Sometimes you just get a little burnt out.
Yes, and I have been doing this. I think I've had 2 breaks of longer than a couple weeks in the last 10 years. I've been doing this for a while. But you know what? On those breaks, by the end of the first week, I got a notebook full of campaign ideas. Even now, doing Nightingale, it's because my other game has been off for most of the last month. My D&D game. Being down to one game has made me want to start up another one. I've filled notebooks with campaign ideas. I'm writing a new game just because I need that outlet. Like, it is a need for me.
Wow. That makes me worry that maybe I don't have what it takes. Or maybe it's more of a thing that, like, you kind of need to... Eventually, you just start doing it for so long that, like, it becomes a part of you.
Probably. I was much crazier before I started playing D&D. But when I started, I had no interest in DMing. I just wanted to be a player. And basically, I took on the mantle like so many before me because no one else would do it.
Yeah.
I wanted the game to happen, so I made it happen.
Oh, I just got an email from John.
Yes, he's in Rhode Island.
He's in town. Speaking of people taking up the mantle.
Or taking up the mantle from people.
Yeah.
John, also known as whatever the
Baird,
fuck his
Baird name. Trumbull.
Halungalum. They are Trumbull. I still get people requesting bringing John back, and trust me, I'd love to. But
if he weren't, the problem is he's a workaholic.
Yes.
Well, not a workaholic, but he's busy saving the world or something.
Workaholic. Something. You can use the phrase workaholic.
Yeah.
He was a workaholic in middle school.
Yes, he was.
But that's, the situation has not that, improved. I always found that very endearing about him. I don't know. It's rare to see people who are...
No, it's a good trait, but yeah, it doesn't lend itself to having a ton of
social
time
life
to do this sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you see him, bug him to come play in a game.
Okay. Yeah.
Tell him how much we miss him.
Yes.
Oh, man. I speaking of playing games, I made a Magic the Gathering deck.
Oh.
I made an EDH deck, actually.
Oh, those are cool.
A Commander deck. I'm scared. Because it turns out, I didn't realize this, but just going through the archives of cards I've had over the years, I apparently have some incredibly potent stuff. Like, as the game continues forward, you start realizing just, you start just kind of accumulating these things over time.
Mirroring I don't want to get back into overpowered shit.
I don't want to get back into that money sink, but, I mean, it was kind of nice to know that, like, apparently a lot of my cards are still relevant, especially in different formats than just standard. But, yeah. Ryan helped me put together an EDH deck, and we tested it out, and it turns out it's pretty fun.
He's still around? He's around until, like, New Year, right?
He's around till the 31st, yes.
I need to see him, and then we can play Magic together.
That'll be great. Perhaps you should see him then. I don't know when he's coming back. He's not
none
here right now.
None of my
now,
decks
he's...
are competitive at all.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. None of his EDH decks are either.
EDH aren't
And I think Magic is not a competitive format. Great until you start playing with strangers. And then realize you're playing a different game than you.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what format. Like, constructed format with strangers, yes. I think sealed with strangers,
sealed, super fun.
Like a draft or the pre-release. Like, those are fun because everyone has an essentially random card pool. So there's a great amount of equalization there.
Yeah, you're not it's playing
an entirely different metagame.
You're not playing a different game.
It's also way more casual.
Everyone is. Yeah, everyone is. No one is coming there with the specific intent to stomp you.
Some people do want to stomp, but sometimes they just absolutely can't because of what
they don't have the luck.
Yeah. So it's, it's more casual.
I got into an argument with a 13-year-old who took objection to the fact that I was picking up the card from the top of my deck while I was untapping.
You're skipping your upkeep, dude.
I think the problem there is that they're a 13-year-old. Not because they're
playing
Magic.
Yeah, tell them to fuck off.
It was, I did.
Say, I'm older than you. Fuck off.
It's like, all right,
he was like, you drew your card, you can't keep untapping. You know, they're different phases.
Well, first off, the untap step isn't... First off, the untap step isn't even a part of the upkeep. Second off, it's mandatory. It's
mandatory.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't one of those you may type things, so he's being a shitheel about the rule for the wrong reason. But yeah, I don't know. It also made me realize that I do not remember how to play Magic.
Hmm.
Other than untap, upkeep, draw. That's like the only thing I remember.
Untap, upkeep,
draw,
and then tell the other person to go. Because you're playing a counter deck.
Ugh. 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 Fucking fuck. Fuckity fuck.
Don't worry. Those are not popular in the current meta.
Yeah. I also found this EDH deck that I have constructed contains within it a wonderful use of one of my favorite cards.
Oh.
Good old Skullclamp is back in action.
Fucking Skullclamp.
Love Skullclamp.
Piece of shit.
You know it's banned in like almost everything except for like Legacy. And it's restricted in Modern, I believe.
Do we have anything else to say on the thing? Because we're still
NPCs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we are
NPCs.
We're still going on.
NPCs are a lot like Magic cards.
Well. All right. Admittedly, I am still scared of GMing, but I think that like if I put some real thought into it, I wouldn't mind taking up the mantle if you ever get burnt out and we run out of ideas after Nightingale. We're never gonna run out of ideas.
Running out of ideas is not the problem. I have five campaigns I'm ready to run at this point.
Yeah.
Like,
man, in Legacy,
it's the time. Like, I have enough campaign ideas right now to last me until I die. Assuming I never have another idea again, I'm still set. It's the will to run them, and the time and opportunity. Because as it turns out, getting six adults to do the same thing at the same time is quite difficult.
Could always steal your time slot for a brand new show.
If you want, man.
Let me think of a campaign idea first. I had some, and then I started it. What I do is, whenever I come up with campaign ideas, I examine them from the role of a 5-year-old child, and I think to myself, is this stupid? Would a 5-year-old child think this is stupid? Usually the answer is yes.
Perfect.
The premise of your campaign will never survive interaction with the table anyway. I don't think we have more to say on
Wait, was that an insult or was that a
sad truth? No, that was not a part. That was a generalized statement.
That's a sad truth.
Sad truth.
Usually what you think your game is going to be about is not what's going to happen.
Huh. Well, that's a relief.
You just got to work with what your players give you.
But I think we've cleanly established that. So yeah, I think that we're all set for tonight.
The only failure in DMing is making an experience that's not fun. And when you realize how much of that isn't even on you. I've granted I have run into DMs who block fun.
Oh, yeah.
I think Kevin and I have the same person in mind.
Yep.
But we're not going to say it.
We're not going to name names, Jamie.
Hey!
So if you're sitting around the table... like, if you're sitting around with a bunch of your friends, fun is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't be so terrible as to obstruct it, and you will be a successful DM.
Yes.
Yay!
Okay. Think we're done on that.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.
Good night.
Whoop.